Civil Justice Committee meeting will come to order, and Representative Jackson moves the minutes of February 15. She moved them on the table. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, today is not, we're taking up the issue of forfeiture. Everybody knows about the gang strike force problems, and most of that is in the Public Safety Committee, but forfeiture is a civil law procedure, so that's in our committee. And so we're going to, this is going to be restricted to the forfeiture issues, basically. And first, we're going to have Mr. Nobles did a report from the legislative auditor, and we're going to hear from him first. Then we're going to, I'm going to present the bill that I put in, and then we'll have, I believe, somebody is going to present, Representative Liebling is carrying one, and somebody, I understand, is going to present that for her, and then we'll take other ideas, and also we'll take testimony from other people. I know law enforcement, I can see, is here. I believe the county attorneys were here. I see DPS. So this is kind of open to, and I think I see somebody from the cities. I'm not sure. So it's kind of to get a lot of information in so that we can kind of formulate a bill here. Mr. Nobles, why don't you go ahead, state your name. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Jim Nobles, legislative auditor for the state of Minnesota, and with me at the table is Sonia Johnson, who is the director of investigations at the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for inviting us. I think, as all of you know, it was about a year ago, exactly, in February of 2009, that the Commissioner of Public Safety asked me if I would do a special review of the Metro Gang Strike Force. And whenever the Office of the Legislative Auditor is asked to do a special review or an investigation or audit that we have not scheduled, we always conduct a preliminary assessment because we're asked to do a lot of them. We can't do all of them. And so we have a process we go through basically to look in a preliminary way at whether it falls within our jurisdiction, whether there really is an issue, and that we should address it immediately. And so we conducted that preliminary assessment of the issues that were presented to us and decided, frankly, rather immediately, that there needed to be a special review of the Metro Gang Strike Force. And so we conducted that review, and we issued our report in May. I don't intend, in line with the chairman's instructions, to go through the entire report. I think I want to focus specifically on the issue that is before you. But it was very central to what we found. We found almost at every turn things that the Gang Strike Force were not as they should be. It was an organization that was not well run in many ways. But very specifically, we found that their seizure of property from people did not have appropriate controls. They were not adequately maintaining the material that they were seizing and then forfeiting some of it. We found an evidence room that was not secured, that was not properly managed. So it raised a lot of questions, frankly, about why this organization was doing what it was doing, because we found a lot of material in the evidence room that was not evidence, and so we ask, why is it here? We also found a large, very large amount of cash that was still on hand. So we determined, and Ms. Johnson actually took several days to count the cash that was there, and so we found that over time this organization was seizing hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash and using its authority basically to go out, seize cash, in part to fund its organization, to fund the Metro Gang Strike Force. And the former commander of the Gang Strike Force, Ron Ryan, was very clear to us that that was part of the strategy, that he felt that his organization was not properly funded by the legislature or through the Department of Public Safety, that he was not getting adequate support. So the Metro Gang Strike Force was using its authority to seize property, cash, vehicles, jewelry, guns, and other material to, in fact, fund its operations. We also found that it was using its authority to seize property from people because the police officers simply felt that the people that they were dealing with shouldn't have those things. And so, again, Mr. Ryan made it quite clear to us that, in part, we were seeing some of the material that we were seeing in terms of vehicles, jewelry, TVs, and other material, frankly, some of which was not subject to administrative forfeiture. Again, raising the question, why are you taking this stuff from people? We did interview former Commander Ryan after we had gathered a good deal of evidence about what was happening. He was retired at the point we interviewed him, but he voluntarily came in, and we conducted the interview, and I want to just mention a couple of things he said to us. We asked him what were the rules, what were the standards that were being used by the gang strike force in going out and taking property from people. And so we ask, when your guys go out to do a search warrant or a bust, how is the property that is seized identified either as evidence or for forfeiture? Is there a clear line and distinction? He said, after talking about a situation where a gun might be involved and that they would take the gun, he talks about going to a bust that would involve a dope dealer. And here's what he said. They, meaning the cops, as he referred to them, or coppers was his term, they go out to some mope. That's a dope dealer. He's never had a job, and he's got this whole array of stuff that's really neat, that's better than the stuff the coppers got in his house. And they have this thing that they don't deserve to have, and so we take it. We're going to forfeit it. You know, that's just the mentality of the coppers. In another situation, we asked him a similar question, and his response was similar. Because coppers like to take as much stuff as they can. And he then referred to the fact that sometimes supervisors needed to restrain officers who were going out on a drug bust or a seizure of some kind, in part because they were bringing back so much stuff from these activities that the facility that the Metro Gang Strike Force had simply couldn't accommodate it. And one of the issues we had as we did our review, again, was that the evidence room was just not well maintained. It was overflowing with material, not adequately recorded in any records. And so we wanted to know, why is all of this stuff accumulating? And again, he says, because coppers like to take as much as they can. That's just the nature of the beast. So supervisors have to tell them, just bring back what we need. But that wasn't happening. In fact, a lot of stuff they didn't need, either as evidence or for any other purpose, was coming back into the gang strike force, cluttering up their organization, and then having to be disposed of in a way that we didn't think was adequate or appropriate. The other thing I want to mention that we found, and I want to say, too, that, you know, we don't look at this issue of forfeiture and seizure of property by police organizations very frequently. But we did in this case, and we looked at whether or not they were following the law in terms of providing notice to people. As I'm sure members of this committee know, there's a notice requirement when you seize property from people. The law basically says you are supposed to give the person from whom you're seizing this property, or someone who has an interest in it, a notice. And within 60 days, they have a right to file a claim for that property and go through a judicial forfeiture process. Otherwise, the material that has been seized will go through an administrative forfeiture process, and the people who previously owned it will lose their property right to that. And we found that in a number of cases, those notices were simply not being provided to people. Ms. Johnson and her team tested 545 situations where there had been property seized, and found that in 202 So quite a large percentage and number. We could find no evidence that individuals had been properly given notice that their property had been seized and that they had a right to file a claim that could potentially get their property back. So that was of great concern to us because this goes to a fundamental right that people have, a provision that this legislature has put in the law that was simply not being followed. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I think I will stop, and if there are questions, either Ms. Johnson or I would be happy to answer them.
Okay. Thank you. I think we're going to take some of the ideas first and then have you available for questions.
Sure,
and then
we will do that.
There's people going to testify on different sides of this, I believe. Thank you. Madam Chair, since we're not taking the bill up, I don't think we have to move it or anything like that.
That's correct, Representative Mueller.
So what I'm going to do is just present my one, which is the first one here. Then there's some other different versions, I believe, coming. I call them more radical, and others call mine too wishy-washy or something. But I think that what we need to do, and I've talked to Mr. Nobles and other people, the biggest problem was out of control things. And so I think that has to be reached in a different manner than the forfeiture bill. And I don't think we should be gutting a good statute that's used in almost all the states. And what I'm going over is, first of all, I have to really extremely thank Ms. Perius for doing a huge effort on this and really helping me an awful lot to understand and get information about these issues in other states. So the first thing I'm just going to run through for those that really haven't looked into this at all, and Ms. Perius, correct me if I make mistakes, which I'm bound to. I'm just going to hit on a few things that I think are important that we consider on changes here, at least. There's a summary forfeiture, which is basically, I don't think anybody wants to get rid of that. It's like if you have drugs that are illegal or something, they can take them. Police radios, there's various things like that under the summary forfeiture. Then there's the administrative forfeiture statute. And I believe that that's mostly drug offenses related to that. And what it briefly does is you give notice, and if it's not contested, then you can do it. There's a presumption of forfeiture, but if the owner sends notice and there's no demand for court within 60 days, I believe there has to be a demand for court within 60 days. No, that's not right, is it? I think I've got that wrong. Ms. Perius.
Madam Chair, Representative, under the administrative forfeiture provision, law enforcement would need to send notice to the owner. If the owner does not respond within 60 days, then it's forfeited by default.
That's what I thought. I had written it down wrong when I copied it off of your memo. So basically, there was three ways that Minnesota differs from quite a few states. One is that the agency can do it without any involvement of a prosecutor. There's no deadline for filing anything to start a judicial procedure after the demand, and there's no cap on the value of it. And my bill would close all of those three holes. They're not really holes, but they're ways that we don't have it as tight as some other states. Then on the judicial civil forfeiture, there was two main differences.
Representative Palmer.
Representative Mueller, are you going through your bill, or are you just sort of giving an overview of it?
I was just giving an overview to say where my bill, an overview, and then where other states are, and that's why my bill deals with those changes.
Now, are you going to go through your bill, or are you going to do that at a different time?
Yes, I'm going to go through the bill.
Thank you.
I just tried to do this first. There's two differences in Minnesota. One is the fixed deadline to start an action we don't have. The other change in Minnesota, or difference in Minnesota from most states, is that Minnesota has a much higher burden of proof than 39 states. They either use preponderance of evidence or probable cause or a lower one. And so while we have a clear and convincing standard, which I remember we were way back in the 80s when I was on civil litigation section, Hennepin County Bar Association, we were asking judges just kind of informally where they thought those standards meant, and it was kind of like, if you had beyond a reasonable doubt the criminal standard here and the preponderance of evidence here, clear and convincing, it'd be right here close to the criminal standard, and then probable cause would be even further over here, as much weaker than even the preponderance of the evidence. So then on a civil judicial forfeiture, it's property associated with specific designated serious felonies against persons or property, certain property felonies, and subject to forfeiture if it's intended for use to commit a designated crime or are proceeds of such a crime. And the county attorney then has to do a complaint and notify an owner. And the designated offense on those has to be established by a conviction. And that doesn't apply to the drug offenses, where they can establish the offense by clear and convincing evidence. And then there's certain elements of if it's in a car or if it's real estate. And then one other procedure that Ms. Perry has found in some states was a forfeiture receipt, which is much like an evidence receipt. It differs from the notice intent to forfeit. I put that forfeiture receipt in my bill. I think it's a good idea. And just to have more record and specificity, and then you can track it easier. Basically, what my bill does is the first provision, I'll go through briefly for each provision. The first one is that when you seize it, you have to have the receipt, the forfeiture receipt, which I just mentioned. Second one is basically just requiring diligence in securing the property. The third provision in mine is that the county attorney may remit, which is if there's an innocent owner defense, or mitigate, which is if there's extreme hardship or extenuating circumstances, and or if it's found that it was done without intent. Then the fourth one is I have DPS have would produce ethical guidelines and procedures for the police and prosecutors, and a certificate of compliance standards. Now, other people, I know that there's a senator that has it, has talked to me about it, and would like to have that done by the county attorneys in accord with the post board, and I'm very strongly considering amending to doing that. The fifth point would be raising the controlled substance value from $25 to $50 if you're seizing the car. And the car, by the way, must have to be associated with a felony-level drug crime. I think the 25 is a little bit low for now. I think 50 is about right, maybe a little high. There's proposals to go to 100 or 200, which I think is pretty high for that. My sixth point is when there's a judicial action, the prosecutor must send the notice to the owner within 90 days of seizure. And because right now we have no limit, most states have a limit on when they have to do that. If it's not done, then the property is returned. But the court could extend it for 90 days for cause. And also later the prosecutor could go back and ask for a forfeiture later after they get more information. The same with an administrative forfeiture. Again, I would put in a new notice to the owner within 90 days, and the court can extend the 90 days. And they can also, if they find later information, even though they've returned the property, they can go back and ask for a forfeiture in court, and that would be limited to a $75,000 value. Right now, we don't have any limits. I think there are state limits, varying ones from, I believe, around $20,000 or something like that, up to, I think, $250,000 or something like that. I thought $75,000 was appropriate. I know there's somebody in the Senate wants to do, it's either $5,000 or $7,500, which even, that's, in my opinion, way too low, because that wouldn't even include most cars nowadays. Very few cars would be qualified. The eighth point that mine has is that we'd have a hearing within, at the earliest practical date, or within absolutely 180 days of the demand by the owner. Right now, I believe we don't have a limit on that. Nine is when police or when the agency, whoever it is, sells the property, they could not sell it to an employee of the agency or a relative of an employee. Number 10 is when the agency gives a forfeiture receipt and the notice seizure of the intent to forfeit, it must include a description of the property and the value, and that goes to the county attorney. And then the county attorney would have to certify that these were all done properly and that there's probable cause for forfeiture. Quite a few of the states do involve the prosecutor, and I think it's good to have them in there and certifying that there's probable cause for forfeiture. And then the last point in my bill is that the proceeds are deposited into a special fund established by the agency, so we can't have any of this money just floating all around, as happened before, as Mr. Nobles mentioned. And it can be spent by the police chief, or if it's prosecuting attorney, the county attorney, and it also has to be put in the prosecutor's fund, and then that has to be reported each year. And that's my provisions. There's another bill that has a few different things. They want to raise the real property would only be subject to forfeiture if there was $4,000 of drugs, which is, I think, awfully high. Right now it's $1,000, and I know that I've heard that law enforcement would be very concerned about that one. Let's see, someone wanted to do a requirement that an administrative forfeiture, they'd, within 10 business days of receiving notice, they'd have to act. I think that's too short for, it's almost not possible to process the file that quick. And that's about the only other ones I've heard of from that one Senate. And then I'm going back up there, and there's a number of other proposals I've heard. I believe somebody is going to present the labeling bill ideas, and then I've heard there's many other ideas.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mallory, thank you for presenting your bill. Can you let us know what process you plan to follow with the bill? For example, if folks have amendments, you know, when is it coming up for an actual vote and passage? And I see that there's a number of sections in here that would be within the jurisdiction of my committee, so a number of these sections would need to be certain to come to the Public Safety Policy Committee. And so it just would be nice to know what you plan to have be your procedure for the rest of this.
Representative Mallory.
I'm thinking of hopefully getting feedback from people on what I had talked to Senator Moo about was working off of this bill. She's introduced the same one, and we would have the committee put change this around however the committee decided on the bill, and then pass it out once we had a committee bill for that, and then it goes to your committee apparently, and that was my belief. And whether that could be done by next Wednesday, I think that may be a little too quick. Hopefully by the following Monday we could have it put together, and in the meantime I was going to try and get feedback where people are on things so that we can try and not have a real long four-hour hearing or whatever on trying to put it together.
Okay, so
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. So it would be your intention then to have another hearing where members would be able to offer whatever amendments they wanted, and then would you have a deadline ahead of time, like a 24-hour rule? Or
so I think it would be probably much further in advance than that, so that I may have a deadline like next week so that we have the ideas in, and then try to, rather than having a kind of a free-for-all in here for hours with somebody throwing something out and then having testifying and arguing about it, I was hoping that we could put something together with an idea. When people get all the ideas on the table and they get a little time to think about them, then I hope we can get feedback as to this idea has a lot of support, this idea has no support, and so that we can put something together that way, because this is such a kind of a area with a lot of ideas in it. I think it's hard to, if we just start coming to a hearing and then having 40 amendments, they could get kind of confusing and they may not even fit together right. And I've told both sides that they should be meeting with the committee members right away so that they don't come in at the next hearing and say, oh, we object to that, and that's the first any of us have heard about it, and things like that.
Okay.
So I want to put it together without a great big mess, hopefully.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Kelly?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mori, it seems to me a lot of times we tend to react to these situations that have happened. Certainly it was embarrassing for the department, and we all went through the hearings, and I think everybody's aware of the situation. I'm just curious, though, have we gone to the department and listed our concerns? Because I noticed that one of them is for the department to develop ethical guidelines and training procedures here, but why not go to the department, allow them to address all these, to say how they're going to fix them, because they're the ones that work with it day in, day out, as opposed to us coming with amendment after amendment and then coming up with a bill and then having the department come back and say, this is why it won't work. I'm just wondering, have we gone to them and say, this are all our concerns. You come up and tell us how you're going to fix it.
Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, Representative Kelly. I think that's what I just said. I want to have everybody have their ideas out on the table and then send them back in so we know where people are. And I know there's going to be some lobbying on different sides that's already started. And I have one provision that would have the DPS doing the guidelines. A couple of other provisions say that it would be done by the county attorneys with the post board, which I think from the arguments I've heard is probably supported more. So it doesn't matter a lot to me on who does that. Most of the issues, I believe, are not on the forfeiture statute of what went wrong. What I'm trying to do with most of these is plug holes that I think Minnesota is too lax on when we look at other states. You know, if Minnesota's one of five states in the country doing a certain thing and all the others are a little tighter, I think we should at least strongly consider doing that. I don't think law enforcement necessarily supports my bill, but I think they don't have objections very serious to it. at least maybe one or provision or something like that, I'm not sure. The county attorneys don't agree with it necessarily, but I don't think they have major problems with it. I think they will be testifying here today. I don't know if law enforcement is here to testify. I'm not sure. I know they will be around to see you. And so I'm trying to put together something that people on the committee will agree to. And I don't think what I have is very radical in here. I think it's pretty much what other states do. And so there's a few things I think most people agree we should probably do. One is the having a prosecutor looking at it because they're an expert on the law and having them okay it. Having a starting time for the, at some time having to start the action rather than, we're one of a very few states, I believe, that don't have some point at which the agency or the prosecutor has to start the action. So there's basically that's what I'm doing. I agree with you that we don't need to do a lot of radical things because a group of cops went out of hand, and that's what I've been maintaining all along. But I'm looking into it, and with Ms. Perry's help, I think we have some holes in our statute we should plug.
Any other questions? All right, Representative Mulder, you can have your gavel back.
Somebody was going to present, I think the bill that Representative Liebling has, is somebody going to present? I assure you she was contacted, and I told her to have somebody here to present the bill, and I've contacted her about it three times, so. Is somebody here from, there's a coalition, I was told by her, of ACLU, and I can't think of the other name, that drafted the bill, she told me, and so I hope that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry for the confusion. I'm Carolyn Jackson from the ACLU of Minnesota, and when I talked to Mr. Baldwin, he said he'd like some background information. I didn't come prepared to give Representative Liebling's bill. I can tell you roughly what's in it.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I'm a co-author of the bill. If you want to ask questions of the witnesses, that I'm sure that would be fine.
Representative Paymark.
I'm not going to present the bill, but I mean, they have, you know, they're fully informed and willing to give testimony about the bill.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to get. I don't want a bill presented in a form like a regular presentation. I want somebody to present the ideas in it so that the committee hears them, so we can think about them.
Absolutely, I can do that.
Okay.
That's not what I had prepared, but I'll wing it. I knew it pretty well. Mr. Chairman, my name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota. The ACLU is the Minnesota branch of the American Civil Liberties Union. We have approximately 8,500 members statewide, and we represent the Bill of Rights. We've been lobbying to change the forfeiture law in Minnesota, and what I'd like to do, first of all, is inform the committee. Administrative forfeiture does not just exist for controlled substances. It also exists under a different statute for DWI. The law is different for DWI. It has a 30-day time period to respond, and there are some other differences in there, but you should be aware there's also administrative forfeiture for driving under the influence. There was a Supreme Court case handed down in December, a Minnesota Supreme Court case called Loss versus 2007 Chevy Tahoe, that radically changed the interpretation of the innocent owner statute, and that's one of the things that is in the Liebling bill, is to address the issues raised in that case. Also, the federal government has an administrative forfeiture law, which was dramatically reformed in 2000. It was a bipartisan effort led by Henry Hyde in the Congress. And that's another law that's out there that's worthy of taking a look at. And it is the federal law is more restrictive than Minnesota law currently is in a number of areas. But to get to, yes,
Jackson, it's also very much more lenient in certain areas too. The federal.
I believe the standard is clear and convincing evidence. I didn't come prepared for that, but I would double check that. I don't. Like I said, I didn't come prepared. Thank you. But that's I. Like I said, I didn't come prepared for that, so I don't.
It's
I'm not
preponderance of the evidence, according to.
Is it?
Well, that's what Ms. Purius says. And I don't think she makes mistakes on that.
Okay, well, like I said, I haven't looked at it for several months. So, but there is, just to be aware that there's also a federal law that has administrative forfeiture for controlled substances. That just to inform the committee, I don't want to pick a fight. So as far as the Liebling bill goes, it's a broad thing. It does basically two things. One is there are a couple of separation of powers issues that are inherent in the existing administrative forfeiture law, and there's also a conflict of interest for law enforcement. So it addresses broadly those two problems, the separation of powers and the conflict of interest. On the separation of powers, there are two separation of powers issues inherent in administrative forfeiture. The first one is between the executive branch, law enforcement, and the judicial branch. With administrative forfeiture, the presumption of innocence is turned on its head. Law enforcement takes your property, gives you a notice, and then it is up to you as the property owner to sue to get your property back. And that's pretty unique in the world of law. If you look at the IRS, the IRS cannot take your money unless they've audited you and given you all sorts of appeals, and it's only when you have exhausted your appeals or decided you're not going to win that then the IRS can take your money. This is opposite of that. Law enforcement takes your property on suspicion of controlled substance activity, and then it's up to you, the property owner, to sue to get it back. If it's under $500, you can go to conciliation court. However, if it's more than $500, you have to pay the $325 filing fee. And then also, it's very complicated. The rules of civil procedure apply. You have to pretty much hire an attorney to get your property back. So you're looking at a minimum of $1,000 investment to get back what may be $500 of cash, or if you have a clunker car that is seized, you know, is it worth it to go to that cost, which you may or may not win. So that's it. As the law is now, the separation of powers is between the judicial branch and the executive branch. Right now, with administrative forfeiture, the policeman on the street is administering justice. You don't get a hearing before the judicial branch unless you take the initiative as a property owner and sue. And this is one of the things that's addressed in the Liebling statute. The other separation of powers issue is the funding issue. This is another thing where it's unique in Minnesota law, to the best of my knowledge, that law enforcement is self-funding with this power. They can go out and they can seize the property, and once they've gone through the forfeiture process, it doesn't necessarily have to go before any other branch of government, and they get to keep 70% of the proceeds. And we believe that it's up to the legislative branch, the elected officials, to raise money and then appropriate it. It should not be in the hands of the executive branch. So this is a pretty unique power, and there's the money that comes in through forfeiture is not really reviewed by any elected body under current law. And so what the Liebling bill does is it takes all the forfeiture law except for the parks and recreation power that was, I believe, last year or 2 years ago, added the power of forfeiture for park rangers. We didn't get into that, but it takes the DWI law, and it takes the controlled substance, it takes the designated forfeiture, and puts it all into one statute. Right now, it's piecemeal all over the Minnesota statutes. It's very confusing. I had to ask several practitioners who do this on a daily basis repeatedly to explain to me how the statute works, and it's very complicated. So one of the main things this bill does is streamline so that anybody can sit down and read and figure out what this law means in it. pulls together these different types of forfeiture. It also eliminates administrative forfeiture and makes it all what is known in Minnesota as designated offense forfeiture, so that there has to be a conviction as part of the element that the prosecutor has to prove in order to do forfeiture. So they have to prove, one, that the person who owns the property was convicted of a crime, two, that the property was either an instrumentality of a crime or represents proceeds from the crime, and if it's an instrumentality, that it's proportional to the underlying crime.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So if they change that law that requires proof of use of an article in a crime, what prevents the accused from selling the car, spending the money, or in some other way disposing of the asset?
The seizure process, Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Representative, the seizure process is the same as under existing law. So if you go in, there's a drug bust, there are $10,000 lying on the dining room table and a pile of coke, the police officer can seize it all, bring it back to, just like they would now, and it is held by the law enforcement agency until the time when the underlying crime is resolved one way or another. So the seizure process is not changed in this bill. So Representative Paymar, where was I? Do you?
You were on the second point of what was required. You said the conviction of the owner. You just mentioned the instrument of the crime, and that's the last place you were.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So that's the nut of what happens in this law. We also look at a number of the processes of how this has worked. I would direct your attention to the innocent owner statute. Like I said, in the last case that was decided in December, it was a situation where it was a married couple. They owned the car jointly. Mr. Loss said good evening to Mrs. Loss at a country club and went home. She then, instead of golfing, went out with her friends and was arrested for DWI. The car was seized, and it was put up for forfeiture. And Mr. Loss said, hey, I am a joint owner of that car. I did not know what my wife was doing that night. I would not have approved of this. And I'd like to keep my ownership interest in the car. And the Minnesota Supreme Court looked at the word owner and constructed that word to mean both Mr. and Mrs. Loss. So Mr. Loss lost his interest in the car, even though he had done nothing. It was completely innocent of any drunk driving offense. And so what we do in this bill is, what's in this bill is that it's that, I'm going to get the exact language here. I can't find it now. But it requires, here we go. Any person who has not been convicted of an underlying crime or the subject of a final implied consent determination that triggers a forfeiture demonstrates by substantial evidence that the person has an ownership interest in the property subject to forfeiture under this section. So basically you come in, you say, here's the title to the car. I own this car. I was not convicted of a crime. The person's interest is not subject to forfeiture unless the prosecutor proves by clear and convincing evidence that the person took the property or interest with the intent of defeating forfeiture, or the person consented to the underlying criminal act or conduct. So it really beefs up the innocent owner protection for both controlled substances and DWIs. One of the other things that's in here is it streamlines the bond for possession language. It's different for DWIs than it is for controlled substances. There are three ways in which you can get your property back pending forfeiture proceedings. One is you can put up a bond, and then the bond money is what would be forfeited. You can submit your title and get the use of your car while the proceeding is planning, or there's also a probable cause hearing where you can request a probable cause hearing, and if there's no probable cause for seizing the property, you can get it back. So it's a little bit of immediate relief.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Jackson.
I've got a question about the requirement of a conviction. What if there is another resolution to the case that might involve a plea, a stay, conditioned on no same or similar, if there isn't a conviction, and yet in a way we don't want to discourage the use of that because it gives people kind of a second chance if they keep their nose clean?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Ms. Jackson.
There is a language in there that a diversion counts the same as a conviction for purposes of forfeiture. So that was put in there for that reason. And if it's insufficient, it can certainly be broadened. But that's the intent is not to push towards conviction when there are other resolutions. So,
I was just looking. You raised the fact that the feds in 2000 or 2001 changed the statute that they had, and you said they made it much more favorable to the owner. I'm just looking through all of the provisions, and in every provision, first of all, they have administrative. They still have administrative.
Yes.
And under each of the provisions, they have Minnesota has, especially if we adopt the two things that are in my bill, Minnesota will have on every provision of that law, we will have a stronger protection of the owner than the federal one. So,
Mr. Chairman, I can't respond to that because I'm not prepared for it today.
You cited that. That sounded like. Are there, I'm sorry, Representative Mahoney, sorry.
Mr. Chair, I must have missed it in your bill, but what both bills are going to do, and I'll ask you and then I can ask the chair. So if there is someone driving someone else's car and they're convicted of a drunk driving offense for their third time, typically we would seize that vehicle, if I remember right, not a lawyer, and what your bill and the chairman's bill makes it simpler to put that car that the owner, who is irresponsible and put a person in a vehicle, allowed a person to use a weapon on a car, on the highways, we're going to give that car back to them and not hold them accountable for their actions? Is that what I'm hearing from both of you? You first and then maybe the chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, that's not what we're saying. If the owner consented to having this person drive drunk, absolutely they can take it. That's not what the bill says. It says that you have to show, though, that it's up to the state to show that the person consented to the use of the car. It's a switch in who has the burden of proving. Am I, the owner of the car, considered guilty until I prove myself innocent, or does the state have to come and show that I consented to letting this dangerous person drive? So, no, we're not saying that the car can never be seized. It just changes who's responsible for making that determination.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney, mine doesn't touch DWIs. I thought that we'd do that later, so mine has no effect on present law on that.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could ask another question of the witness.
Yes, Ms. I'm sorry, Representative Mahoney.
So, how, I'll phrase it this way. It would be relatively simple if I borrowed my car to someone, fully knowing that they were going out golfing at a tournament that had a beverage cart of free beverages that they were drinking, and I should think about that, but to say, boy, I just thought they were going to go play golf. I never could have assumed that they would have a beer. That would be a pretty simple defense. And I think with that provision, you're unlikely to ever seize a vehicle that was used in a DWI, period, whether they had knowledge or not. Just a non-lawyer's kind of look at that particular one.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, was that a question?
Ms. Jackson?
No, I don't think so. Just a comment.
In response, it's all about who the decision maker is. If the language is too loose for you, it can certainly be amended to be tighter. But the principle involved in who's the decision maker, does the state have to prove that this person was reckless, or is it assumed that the person was reckless, and then they have to prove that they were not? So it's a shift in the burden of who has to make that proof. And
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I doubt that you could make that particular provision tough enough. I have believed for many years that if you are caught driving drunk, if your car is a $100,000 Mercedes-Benz or a $1,000 clinker, it should be seized by the state or the municipality or whomever, because you have taken a weapon onto the street. We would seize a gun from someone that shot at someone. We should take a vehicle that is used as a weapon in a crime. Just my thoughts, and it's not a question.
It's just about the person. Excuse me.
Ms. Jackson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say it's about the presumption of innocence, that in this country you're presumed innocent until the state has proven that you are guilty, and that's what we're trying to address here.
Okay. Representative Kelly's next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jackson, my question goes back to the joint ownership issue, and it appears to me that we may be opening up an opportunity for kind of a free pass in a marriage situation, because if we look at joint property held, whether it's a title or something, as a matter of a transfer of assets upon a death, everything goes to the spouse because they're considered joint owner. So where will that be able to be stopped, to be able to say in a marriage situation, well, my husband did this or my spouse wife did this, but we're joint owners, so I should get the property back?
Ms. Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, I believe that this decision that was handed down by the Minnesota Supreme Court opened up that issue. Prior to this decision, it was, I think, assumed that if you were not guilty of a crime, the state could not take your property under forfeiture. And I believe that the guidance from the Minnesota Supreme Court was for the legislature to look at this issue and to debate it. So I think prior to this decision, it was assumed that if you were a joint owner and you were innocent, your property could not be taken, and now that's changed. And it's a policy question for the legislature to decide whether that's the way the law should be.
I believe that's correct. Representative Olin's next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but my comments are going to be very brief. Obviously, I'm going to have extreme difficulty imagining this provision under any circumstances, but I don't think today is it my time to sit and debate this longer. It will come up again.
Thank you, Representative Champion.
Well, I do agree that this is going to be one of those bills that would require us to think about it from various perspectives. Representative Mahoney raises a very interesting point, but I think one that is, you know, probably full of, you know, not fully understanding how these things sort of work from a legal perspective. I do agree that one should never be able to use a vehicle or any particular thing as a weapon. I think there needs to be some consideration to what if a person falls asleep at a light, doesn't injure anyone, police happen to come, and this person is arrested for a DWI. Then could we really say that that person used a vehicle as an instrumentality or as a weapon? I would probably argue not under those circumstances. I could also think about a person who goes to play golf who may have had two DWIs, you know, early on in their life, but maybe they had 7 years of sobriety. Person lets them use their car to go play golf, but they've had 7 years of sobriety. So why should I, as an innocent person, now be told you had to think or know that they were going to have a glass of beer? Not necessarily, because I've had this experience where they've had 7 years of sobriety. So I think for us to entertain ourselves around the table of all of the possibilities of what could happen under those circumstances, I think we should do that, but I think we should weigh it and really weigh it with an open mind. And so I am one who firmly believes The due process is something that should always be the order of the day, because that's a guiding principle whenever we think in terms of someone taking our life, liberty, or property. That we should look at that with every ounce of consideration, and even if we feel strongly about it, that person still has a right to be heard. And anything that undermines their ability to be heard and to be heard fairly is something that I find unconscionable. So I hope as we weigh this and we think about it in real time, that we understand that there are varying opinions, but the guiding principle is that we as Americans should always have an opportunity and an option, whether I'm married to someone or not, to be heard. Because I know that my wife does not do all that I ask her to do, nor I do everything that she asks me to do. But should she be held responsible for the errors of her husband's ways? Absolutely not, she would argue. But I'm only suggesting that we must put it all in perspective and not allow our own personal thoughts and biases to shade our ability to understand that we do not want to erode our Constitution or our right to life, liberty, or property.
Okay, I got word that the county attorneys wanted to testify on that. I'm sorry, Representative Olin before.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a quick suggestion. I think, at least from my legal background, I would appreciate if everybody could get a copy of this case that she's referring to so we can actually have it when this discussion comes up into greater detail.
Representative Olin, we can have the committee administrator send that out. I've already read the case, and probably some of the others on the committee have. Is it Mr. Kingery or Mr. Brown that's testifying? I was told yesterday that county attorneys wanted to testify. So I guess that's all the questions for you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I apologize for not coming right up. I thought with Ms. Jackson up here that you were still asking her questions. I have a handout for the committee, please. Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Kingery,
members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And we are handing out, or what's being handed out, is what we're calling our forfeiture guiding principles. It was adopted by our board of directors last October. And what it is basically a rewrite of some previous principles that we had that were probably 10 or 15 years old. Knowing this issue was going to come up before the legislature, we decided to revisit that. And what you have is the newest updated version of our guiding principles. I'll just make a few comments with regard to the principles. I've got a couple of comments also on the bill, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
As you see right out in the first sentence, that we believe forfeiture has been a valuable tool for law enforcement here in Minnesota. Going down with our numbers here under guiding principles, it's our belief that those that are involved in criminal activity should not be allowed to retain the proceeds or of the property used to facilitate that activity. And we believe that the statutes further an important public safety and justice function. Two, forfeiture should only occur in a separate civil proceeding according to civil standards of proof, and any resolution of a criminal case should be independent of any forfeiture. Number three, notice of forfeiture should be given promptly to the potential claimant and to the prosecuting agency. And we believe that's appropriate to provide for due process, and that notice represents the first critical step in tracking the care and disposition of seized property. When we receive notice that property has been seized, by providing a copy of that notice to the appropriate prosecutor in a timely manner, we believe it serves an important oversight function by allowing the prosecutorial agency to track the property. And I believe that's consistent with your bill, Mr. Chairman. And if a claimant contests the forfeiture, the prosecutorial agency should review the claim and make a determination on how best to proceed. And the property that's seized and ultimately forfeited that there should be a notice from the prosecutorial agency to the law enforcement agency that the time for contesting the forfeiture has passed and that no claim has been made, and that the or that the matter has been finally resolved either by settlement or in accordance with the statutory process. Four, if property is taken in conscious or reckless disregard of the law, that property should be returned unless it is contraband. The rights of innocent owners should be respected and protected in the forfeiture process. Again, we believe that the law, both in statute and case law, allows for that. And that forfeiture proceeds should be used to supplement law enforcement and prosecutorial funding. We don't believe it's appropriate for forfeiture funds to be sort of part of the county attorney's or law enforcement budget. We think that would provide for inappropriate incentives, both, quite frankly, for those that fund those agencies, as well as just the whole issue regarding forfeiture. And we just feel that if it was considered to be part of the budget, and your bill does not do that, Mr. Chairman, although I do have a comment on that section of your bill, if it's considered part of the budget, that the boards that set our funding could anticipate future revenue when considering it as a budget offset. With regard to your bill, Mr. Chairman, in Section 3 under the petition, one other comment. And the reason we did guiding principles is any bills that are introduced on this issue, we compare them, we look at them, with regard to our guiding principles in terms of whether they meet them or not. We know there's going to be multiple forfeiture bills, and we didn't want to get into dueling bills and trying to pick one over the other. If any bill matches these or comes close to it, then fine. We believe that it's an appropriate change. Your bill, Mr. Chairman, comes of the ones that I've seen introduced, comes closest to that. But in Section 3, with regard to the disposition of property, the disposition could be after a court order. So the court says, okay, you've seized it, it's now forfeited, you go sell it. That would potentially the county attorney in the position of making a decision, pulling it back after a court order, but before it's been deposed. So I don't have any magic language for you this morning, but I think that's something we should consider in the future.
Mr. Kingery, can I just to clarify? So under the remission or mitigation part, yes, you're saying that this would allow a county attorney to pull it back after a court order for sale?
That's how we would look at it, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kingery, can you get me language? Because that was not my intention. It was before it got that far.
I thought so, Mr. Chair.
Because at that point, the person would have been able to come forth to the court with all of their defenses and extenuating circumstances and everything else. So I think that's, we have the same intention, and maybe I just didn't get the right language.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In Section 4, ethical guidelines, speaking only to prosecutors, only to the attorneys, and with all due respect to the Department of Public Safety, we just believe that's not the right agency to set ethical standards for lawyers. That's what the Supreme Court does, and if we violate those standards, we are held accountable. And we just don't believe that the Department of Public Safety should be setting ethical guidelines for attorneys. I will let law enforcement speak for themselves, but
Mr. Kingery,
we believe the Supreme Court is adequate.
Okay, and as I said before, I kind of like the idea of going to the county attorneys and the post board to determine those guidelines. Would that solve your problem, or is it still, you still have a problem?
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, if you're suggesting whether the Minnesota County Attorneys Association would develop guidelines for their members? That's an interesting thought, Mr. Chairman.
I have an issue. Who do you suggest? Normally we don't have, I'm not a prosecutor, so I don't, we've got two or three here. Would the court get into these kinds of things? And they certainly couldn't, because there's an intertwining here between what law enforcement does and the county attorneys, and so it would seem to me that the post board should have some say in the county attorneys and maybe the courts, but this is a kind of a minor point to me. We need ethical guidelines, is my opinion.
Right.
And I think you'd agree with that. So we can work on ideas on how to, who sets that and how it's set up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I could just make a couple of very quick comments. Again, the belief that the Supreme Court sets our ethical guidelines, we all know what brought us here. And if attorneys were involved in that and they were found guilty, I am sure the Supreme Court would look at that and have something to say about their licenses. You also have a piece in here on training. I can guarantee you that whatever bill is going to pass this year, and there's going to be DWI bills that are out there as well, as you know, Mr. Chairman, that we will attempt to provide training. I'm saying attempt because in past years we've received $65,000 a year from the Attorney General to provide training for prosecutors. That has been removed from us for the next 2 years. And so it will be a challenge to provide training, but we'll do our best.
One other question, Mr. Kingery. I guess what I was most concerned, we'll ask Mr. Nobles, but I don't think there was any allegations of improper prosecutor language. And so I guess maybe what I was thinking of was the post board and the county attorneys working together on the law enforcement guidelines, and that was pretty much my where I was coming from. So maybe we can work on language. Okay. Representative Olin, did you have a? Oh, I'm sorry.
I have one more comment on that section, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The other idea is, and I'm not authorized to throw this out there, but I've suggested in several forums, is that I believe law enforcement and prosecutors should make available to the public what their forfeiture guidelines are. With regard to charging policies, it is in statute that we have to, if asked, what our charging policies are for our offices. It would seem, this is all about a number of issues, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, but it is about accountability. And it's my belief that at a minimum we should do that. We have not taken a position on that, so I'll just state that as my personal belief, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Mr. Kingery, I think everything you said is in line with what I'm trying to do. So. I'm sorry.
If I, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if there's a question on that, I'd be happy to answer. But otherwise, I've got just two or three other comments on the bill. Within 90 days, the notice procedure. One concern that we have there, and I think we can come up with language, Mr. Chairman, and then we can get an extension for a period not to exceed 90 days for good cause, is, again, we're talking about a civil proceeding. I think you would not want a situation where someone is deposed in a civil proceeding and that testimony could then later be used in a criminal proceeding. So there may be reasons for not wanting to adhere to these timelines, if you will, Mr. Chairman. One could interfere with the others. There could be strategic reasons for why you'd want to delay it or speed it up on both sides, quite frankly, for both the defense and the prosecution. So I think that is something that we need to look at.
Mr. Kingery, before you go on, could you do you have contact with other states? Because other states have those limits in them, and maybe how do they work out that problem? Maybe you can look into that.
And I believe I just have one other section with regard to where the funds are deposited. As you know, both from law enforcement and prosecutors, it is deposited within a separate account within the county account, and is used for training or capital equipment and so forth, and it's not considered part of the that office's budget. Again, it's statute, it supplements the budget. I made the grievous error when I testified on this issue in October when I said it's supplanted. It does not, it supplements. And again, primarily, almost universally used for training purposes. Concern, I think, with this language is that we would then have to go to the county, in this case, the county board, and request to draw out the money and to buy a new computer system or to attend some particular training. And I think we get into the slippery slope of having the county board second-guess purchases that we're making, or the county board ultimately considering, well, this is sort of part of your budget. You've got $10,000 in your forfeiture account. We can see how you're spending it. We think you should spend it on this. And our concern is it could be part of the setting of the budget for the county attorney or for law enforcement, and we believe that is inappropriate. And the Lugar report commented on that, that it should not be used for operations, and that's one concern we would have about the way that I know your intent, Mr. Chairman, but that's one concern we'd have about the way that language is drafted.
Thank you. Let's see. Representative Jackson, I believe, is first. Or was Druskowski first? Okay. I was given Jackson first. I didn't see either one.
So. Thank you, Representative. I like this gentleman. I've got a question on the forfeiture proceedings used to supplement. I'm wondering how you get around the potential for the conflict of interest and also the accountability piece. I can see using a portion of it to cover the administrative costs of handling it and personnel. I'd frankly be more comfortable with it turned over to an elected body who has to be accountable to all the money. There is the fear, like you said, that if it's the county, even though it's supposed to supplement, they're going to see it as a part. And to avoid that and this conflict of interest, what about allowing each county to keep a portion for, percentage for administration and turn it over to the state?
Mr. Kingery.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, give the money over to the state?
No idea.
Well, I suppose that's one way to balance the budget. But quite frankly, Representative Jackson, you mentioned...
You gave him a heart attack.
No, you didn't. I expected that at some point, and I believe it's in one of the bills in the Senate anyway, and it's an issue that's in play. We know that. With regard to giving that authority, that determination to an elected body, we do that now. County attorneys and sheriffs are duly elected. They mess up. If there's something that is inappropriate in their counting or the money is spent wrong, they don't fulfill their duties, they're held accountable 4 years from now. They're accountable this fall when they run for election or for re-election. So we believe that is the safeguard, Representative Jackson.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kingery, maybe I have more of a comment than a question. I had the same line of questioning as a representative did. I think you look at this issue, and the question that comes to me is accountability. Mr. Kingery, there's a reason the commissioners are elected, and they're elected to look after the people's money, and I find your response to Representative Kulig-Jackson's question to be very interesting, to say the least, to almost suggest that there's an entitlement to that money among the county attorneys. There is not. That's the reaction I got from you, or at least that I saw, and I could have been off base. But I would urge your organization to take a closer look at this and reconsider some of that, because we're at a point in our history right now where people are talking about how accountable the government is to the people and the government getting away from the people. I have seen examples in counties where county attorney's offices have gone and sued their county commissioners for certain reasons around the budget. There are efforts afoot in the legislature, ideas coming forth. I know the Association of Minnesota Counties, for one, is looking at throwing out the requirement that the counties have an attorney to begin with, to give the counties the flexibility that they need and the people should be able to have to wield the people's decisions in their county government. And so that's really the end of my comments, and any reactions you have would be appreciated.
Mr. Chairman,
representative of the committee, representatives, members of the committee, I certainly didn't mean to suggest, and I apologize if I did, that we didn't believe in accountability. We certainly do. And again, it's my belief that part of that accountability lies with these individuals being elected officials, like the county board members. These are in separate accounts. They can be viewed by the public. They can be viewed by the county commissioners. It's there. They know that. We're familiar with the AMC proposal, and what I would challenge AMC to do is, rather than merging a function here or a function there, the real issue is, do we need to merge counties? It doesn't seem to make sense to simply merge a little function here or a little function there. I think it has to be part of a broader discussion.
not just merging county attorneys or sheriffs or human services. Some of that is going on right now, not necessarily a formal merger, but in terms of memorandums of understanding, joint agreements between counties in which county attorneys are agreeing, okay, you can take child support, I'll take CHIPS. Some of that is going on right now, and we believe in the long run that that will help achieve efficiencies. But it is a discussion that needs to take place in terms of do we need to start merging some functions? I don't question that at all.
I think the sheriffs and chiefs, did they want to testify, or just are they viewing it for consideration? Doesn't matter. It's up to you. I believe that was all the questions from Mr. Kingery.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriffs Association. We'll be very, very brief and just simply say that we do have some concerns. Mr. Kingery has highlighted those already. In the interest of time, we will just work with the committee and the chairs, you and Ms. Hillstrom, as a bill proceeds forward, make our comments known at that time. So we'll work with you on our concerns. But John Kingery has detailed a number of concerns that we currently have. I would just say, with regards to the issue of the sheriff, the county attorney, and the board, let's remember one thing. We all represent the people. We are elected officials. This is not a them against us. When the money is placed in an account, in order for that money to be expended, the sheriff or the county attorney brings the expenditure to the county board and tells them what they're expending it for, and there's concurrence. I'm not aware of a single dispute on forfeiture money spent by the sheriff or the county attorney with the county board. It has been a cooperative venture to serve the people. So I think we're trying to solve a problem that virtually is non-existent, at least in greater Minnesota, and it certainly has nothing to do with the gang strike force issue that has brought us to this point.
Thank you. And Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just offer, I didn't catch your name.
Jim Franklin.
Mr. Franklin. As a matter of fact, not specifically forfeiture money, but budgets generally, there have been discrepancies between county boards and county attorneys and sheriffs in greater Minnesota, and I know that for certain.
Representative, Mr. Frank. Chair, that is correct, and I think the position of the sheriffs and the county attorneys is that the sheriff and the county attorney is elected by all people of the county. Not a portion or a district, but all the people. And when a county sheriff or a county attorney does not have sufficient funds by which to run their office, then that means there has to be an avenue of appeal to looking at that and how we adjust that in order to serve all of the people. And again, it's a cooperative venture. That particular issue is a sore point for the county attorneys and the sheriffs and the county board. We do work it out in 99% of the cases, but there's always that 1 or 2% that is problematic.
Thank you. Does anybody have questions? Mr. Nobles has waited for any questions that there might be on his report.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just
did you
sum up our position. I know that you dealt with issues about committee jurisdiction, and I know that the issue more directly about the structure of the Metro Gang Strike Force will be dealt with elsewhere. But I do think I have to say that, you know, you can sit here and write all the laws you want on the way you expect seizures and forfeitures to go, but you need to make sure that there's a structure out there for these multi-jurisdictional strike forces and task forces that in fact ensure the accountability that those laws will be followed, because clearly in the case we examined, the law was not followed. So I think for us the issue is, beyond what you write in the law, what structure will there be there? And you had an organization that was not accountable to an elected body, either a county board, an elected sheriff, or anyone else. They took the money, they put it in their own account, and they used it for whatever purpose they decided. That's the issue. And I realize you want to go beyond that with your bill, but I think this issue about these multi-jurisdictional police operations is still very much with us.
Mr. Nobles, I totally agree with you, but I didn't want to get into Representative Hellstrom's jurisdiction, so I'm just dealing with the civil law, which is in this committee, and I totally agree that we need to look at that. And
Mr. And Chairman, Representative Hellstrom do understand the sensitivity about committee jurisdiction, but since some of you are on those other committees and will deal with that issue, I just thought I'd take this opportunity to make that statement.
And once again, I want everybody to understand, we're not going to have another hearing and have about 30 amendments coming in with a bunch of new testimony. I sent to every member of the House that they were supposed to have somebody presenting their ideas on this today so we could sort them all out, and start thinking about them. And that's what I want everybody to do, is think about them. There's a number of representatives from different sides in the audience. I hope you will talk to the members now, not wait till the last hearing on it. And we can try to put something together on this that makes sense, because there's a lot of different provisions. We have to fit them together and make sense and come out with something. I hope that will be done before the next hearing. So with that, we will get out anything we receive, and I'd like to have anything, your thoughts, as soon as possible. So with that, meeting's adjourned.